Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 21st, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows an ocean scene. The sea is rough. The skies are gray. In the foreground is Uncle Sam. He's just barely got his head and one hand above water. Looks like he's screaming for help. Not far behind him is actually a U.S. Coast Guard boat. But on the deck of the boat are the Republican elephant and the Democratic donkey, and they're struggling over the life preserver. The headline is, "Help Isn't Coming," as millions of Americans face poverty and eviction, federal relief bill stalls. And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. Federal aid lapses as negotiations break down. What happened? Tens of millions of unemployed Americans were left in limbo this week after negotiations over a congressional relief bill collapsed and several aid-focused executive actions by President Trump faced possible legal challenges and other obstacles. Trump signed the orders after 2 weeks of talks between Democratic leaders and administration officials sputtered out with no agreement on a bill to extend federal unemployment supplements that lapsed July 31st. "Our differences are vast," said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi after she and Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer reached an impasse with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. The Democrats' starting point was a $3.4 trillion package that extended the $600 weekly supplements to the unemployed for 6 months. The administration backed a $1 trillion bill that cut the payments down to an initial $200 a week. The Democrats' proposal also called for $915 billion in aid to state and local governments facing massive budget shortfalls, which Republicans opposed. Democrats said they'd compromise on a $2 trillion bill, a figure Meadows flatly rejected. Trump's executive actions would provide $300 in weekly unemployment supplements by siphoning dollars from the Federal Disaster Relief Fund. It would also temporarily suspend collection of payroll taxes. Initially, the plan required matching $100 state payments, a provision dropped after an outcry from cash-strapped governors. Critics questioned the legality of Trump's orders, noted that he didn't halt evictions, and warned that the jobless payments could take weeks to implement and that the fund would run out after 5 weeks. Pelosi called the measures meager, weak, and unconstitutional, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell praised Trump for acting. "Struggling Americans need action now," he said. The July jobs report last week showed rehiring had dramatically slowed down from June as a coronavirus surge forced many states to tighten restrictions again. Governors called on the warring sides to return to the bargaining table and hash out a bill including a new round of $1,200 stimulus payments and aid for businesses and schools. "They need to pull together," said Ohio Republican Governor Mike DeWine. But with Congress leaving Washington for August recess and Meadows also going on vacation, no new negotiations were scheduled. What the editorial said, "Congress' failure to deliver a relief bill is unconscionable," said the Houston Chronicle. An estimated 32 million Americans are drawing unemployment, many displaced from jobs that may never return. While covering their rent and grocery bills, the federal payments boosted consumer spending, rescuing the economy from cratering debts that could take decades to overcome. Millions now face evictions. Homelessness could reach Great Depression levels. It's time to set partisanship aside and show the American people that the government can actually get things done. Democrats' demands are unreasonable, said NationalReview.com, but Trump's actions are an abuse of presidential authority. His unilateral moves are an end run around the Constitution, which gives Congress sole power over spending. Republicans rightly objected when Obama overreached with his executive orders and should object now to this violation of our system. What the columnist said, Trump's measures will do little to deliver cash anytime soon to Americans who need it, said Jim Tankersley in the New York Times. His use of disaster relief funds for unemployment payments will almost certainly be challenged in court. And Trump did nothing to help small businesses or state governments facing bankruptcy. He's making a political bet that it's better to make a show of helping the economy than to have actually helped it. Trump's unilateral action was politically brilliant, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. Democrats thought they could use Americans' wrath over lost aid to blackmail Republicans into swallowing another $3.4 trillion in wild deficit spending. Now the political tables are turned. Trump will get credit for extending the relief, and any lawsuits Democrats might bring to stop it would be political suicide. The obscene Republican resistance to extending unemployment insurance isn't just about a few billion dollars, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. It reveals the rancid core of conservative free market economics. A mountain of new research refutes Republicans' assertions that the payments discourage large numbers of workers from returning to their jobs. But Republicans' moral horror that a handful of Americans might be gaming the system outweighs the genuine desperation of millions. Buckle up. We're headed into a global depression, said Ian Bremmer in Time.com, with unemployment numbers dizzyingly high and COVID-19 continuing its march across the U.S. and the globe, we face a period of economic misery that few living people have experienced. Even a vaccine won't flip a switch and bring the world back to normal. Recovery will be slow and come in fits and starts. A very difficult year lies ahead. Second, shorter main story. Biden makes history with Harris VP pick. What happened? Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden this week selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, a historic decision that makes Harris the first woman of color to run for vice president on a major party ticket. A former San Francisco prosecutor and California attorney general, Harris battled Biden for the center lane during the Democratic primary, scoring a viral breakout in the first televised debate when she sharply criticized Biden for his opposition to mandatory busing in the 1970s. After leaving the presidential race in December, the 55-year-old Harris soon made up with Biden, 77, and began acting as a campaign surrogate for the former vice president. Biden said he partly decided to pick Harris as his running mate because of her close friendship with his late son, Beau, who was Attorney General of Delaware when Harris held the position in California. There is no one's opinion I valued more than Beau's, he said, and I'm proud to have Kamala standing with me on this campaign. Biden noted at an event in Delaware that Harris' background reflects a diversifying country. The daughter of immigrant academics, an Indian mother and a Jamaican father, she became only the second black woman U.S. senator in history when elected in 2016. One of the reasons that I chose Kamala, said Biden, is that we both believe that we can define America simply in one word, possibilities. In her first speech as Biden's running mate, Harris said Americans will face a stark choice when they decide between Biden and President Trump in November. Everything we care about, our economy, our health, our children, the kind of country we live in, it's all on the line. What the columnist said. Young progressives aren't happy with this choice, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. Harris' record as a California prosecutor, when she fought to uphold wrongful convictions, has not aged well in the era of Black Lives Matter. As a senator, she's been overly chummy with Wall Street. But Harris has moved leftward in recent months and now champions criminal justice reform, marijuana legalization, and tax credits to help lower and middle-class families. Harris isn't the VP candidate of the left's dreams, but she might be a good policy influence on Biden if he treats her as a real governing partner. Harris is no moderate, said NationalReview.com in an editorial. During the Democratic debate, she pledged that if elected president, she'd outlaw so-called assault rifles by executive order. Never mind that the Constitution grants the president no such power. She briefly supported abolishing private health insurance and mandating Medicare for all, and has proposed that states should get preclearance from the federal government before changing abortion laws. That Harris might be only a heartbeat from the presidency is terrifying. Like her politics or not, Harris' nomination is a turning point for Democrats, said Ronald Brownstein in TheAtlantic.com. While the GOP remains dominated by white men, starting with Trump and Vice President Mike Pence, Biden understands that his party needs to more closely resemble the base of voters that elects it to power. Democrats haven't put two white men on a presidential ticket since 2004. It's difficult to imagine when they ever will again. Controversy of the week is titled Election Interference, a Politicized Warning. After nearly 4 years of Donald Trump, Americans are suffering from scandal fatigue, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. But if we care at all about our democracy, Trump's persistent refusal to defend our elections from Russian interference should be deeply alarming. Under pressure from Democrats, William Evanina, Trump's director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, last week grudgingly admitted that Russia is again using an unspecified range of measures to get Trump reelected. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, who's been briefed on the intelligence, said Evanina's vague warning omitted chilling details of Russia's sophisticated tactics and techniques that apparently make its 2016 interference in Trump's behalf look like child's play. To appease Trump, Evanina also stated that China and Iran want Biden to win, said Samantha Vinograd in CNN.com. But are they actually interfering in the election? Evanina cited only Beijing's public criticism of Trump's pandemic response and warned that Iran may spread anti-U.S. content online. This false equivalency between other nations' preference for Biden and Russia's active multi-pronged campaign to re-elect Trump indicates our intelligence agencies have become politicized. Evanina actually deserves some credit, said TheDispatch.com in an editorial. His statement was much harder on Russia than on Iran. He explicitly accused a pro-Russian Ukrainian operative, Andriy Derkach, of spreading disinformation to undermine former Vice President Biden's candidacy and the Democratic Party. As for China, some experts say Beijing's meddling campaign might simply be more clandestine than the brazen Russian equivalent. There's no question that foreign adversaries are trying to delegitimize our election, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. But so are our two political parties. With Democrats still obsessed with Russia and Republicans attacking mail-in voting, each side is building excuses to challenge a loss in November. That jeopardizes our nation's greatest feat, the peaceful transition of power. We're losing something else we used to value, said Robert Draper in the New York Times, the independence of our intelligence services. From the day he took office, Trump has reacted with rage to any mention of Russian interference in the 2016 and 2020 elections. The few intelligence chiefs willing to tell him unwanted truths, most notably Dan Coats and Joseph McGuire, were systematically purged and replaced with unqualified Trump loyalists. The intelligence community as a whole, insiders say, now routinely edits and softens its conclusions about Russia. Officials know if they do not, they will be replaced with a more sycophantic alternative. It gets worse, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Evanina made it clear that Trump's Republican allies in Congress are actively cooperating with Russia to manufacture dirt on Joe Biden. The intelligence chief said that Derkach, the Kremlin operative, is peddling the same story now being investigated by Senator Ron Johnson, the Republican from Wisconsin, that Biden's insistence as vice president that Ukraine rid itself of corruption was a plot to protect his son Hunter's Ukrainian employer from prosecution. Johnson's obvious plan is to produce a bombshell report on the Bidens just before the election. The plan may not work, said Greg Sargent and Paul Waldman in thewashingtonpost.com. Trump's own intelligence chief has just identified the bogus narratives Republicans plan to use against Biden as Russian disinformation. That will make Johnson's so-called bombshell look a whole lot more ridiculous. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for buying a generator. After the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association warned the U.S. is facing one of the most active hurricane seasons on record. NOAA said there may be as many as 25 named storms and 11 hurricanes, including 6 that could be major. It was a good week for life in exile. After Prince Harry and Meghan Markle and baby Archie moved into an $8 million home in exclusive Santa Barbara, California, that they bought with help from Harry's dad, Prince Charles, their neighbors include Ellen DeGeneres and Oprah Winfrey. It was a good week for female solidarity after former Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin posted congratulations and advice to Democrat Kamala Harris, including, trust no one new, ignore deceptive handlers trying to change you, and have fun. But it was a bad week for romance. After a British man lit hundreds of tea candles in his apartment, poured 2 glasses of wine, then went to fetch his girlfriend to propose, the couple returned to find the apartment engulfed in flames, but firefighters said she still said yes. It was a bad week for Phoenix, the warmest city in the U.S., which broke its own record for the most 110-degree days in a single year, with 35 and counting, and is having its hottest summer in history. And it was a bad week for New Zealand, which had its record of 102 days without a single new coronavirus case broken when 4 members of a family in Auckland tested positive. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern immediately reimposed tight restrictions on the country, which has had just 1,125 confirmed cases and 20 32 deaths. And a short news piece before we move on. Pompeo warns Russia on Afghan bounties. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo rebuked his Russian counterpart over intelligence reports that Russia paid bounties for the killing of American service members in Afghanistan, despite President Trump's insistence that allegations about the covert program are another Russia hoax. A report from the New York Times this week revealed that while the State Department has been careful not to discuss the bounties publicly, Pompeo raised the issue with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in a July 13th phone conversation. The Times first reported in June that a Russian military intelligence unit rewarded Taliban-linked fighters for killing American soldiers. Since then, Trump has spoken with Russian President Vladimir Putin at least twice without discussing the matter. We're on the briefing page. Title this week is A Mania for Mars. Three countries just launched unmanned missions to the red planet in hopes of finding evidence of life. Why the fascination with Mars? Who's going to Mars? The United Arab Emirates kicked off a trio of missions with the July 19th launch of its orbiter, Hope. China followed 4 days later with Tianwen-1, literally Questions to Heaven, a three-pronged mission that includes a lander, a rover, and an orbiter. NASA concluded the fireworks on July 30th with Perseverance, designed to put the largest, most sophisticated rover yet on Mars. Each of the new missions will arrive at Mars in February, with both NASA and China looking for evidence that there is current microbial life under the surface or that such life once existed there. Such a finding would be extraordinary and indicate life may exist in many other places in the universe, said Dr. Sarah Johnson, a planetary scientist at Georgetown University. In a memoir called Sirens of Mars, Johnson writes about how the search for life on the planet inspired her to become a planetologist. Mars, she writes, has long been humanity's mirror, our foil, a telltale reflection of what has been deepest in our hearts. Mars has been a blank canvas, and tenderly, our human seeking has rushed to fill it. What is so interesting about Mars? The fourth planet from the sun is more like Earth than any of the others. It's about half our planet's size, has variable seasons, polar ice caps, and plains and gullies possibly shaped by water flow. All of that, said David Weintraub, a professor of astronomy at Vanderbilt University, made it easy for us to tell ourselves that life was likely to have emerged there. At the same time, its relative proximity, in October it will swing to within 38.6 million miles of Earth, has made it seem within reach of a space mission. The interest in Mars was ignited in 1877 when the Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli noted a series of mysterious lines seemingly etched into the Martian surface. He described them as canali, which literally means channels, but was mistranslated into canals, carrying the hint that they had been constructed by intelligent life. The idea was seized upon some 20 years later by the influential American astronomer Percival Lowell, who theorized that the canals were created by an accident. An ancient dying civilization to channel water as the Martian surface dried into the red desert it is today. The canals run for thousands of miles in an unswerving direction, as far relatively as from London to Bombay, Lowell wrote. Later, the lines were proved to be nothing more than an optical illusion. Which nation will get there first? In July 1965, NASA achieved the first successful flyby with a craft called Mariner 4. During ensuing decades, the U.S. and the Soviet Union periodically dispatched orbiters and landers to the planet. During the late 1990s, NASA's Mars Global Surveyor discovered dry riverbeds and evidence of glacial activity, suggesting that water once existed in abundance on Mars. Since water is associated with life, the finding reignited interest in Mars. In subsequent years, the U.S., Russia, China, and other nations sent nearly 20 missions there. NASA's Curiosity rover has been exploring the planet since 2012. Have we found life? No, although the question isn't without controversy. The 1976 NASA mission discovered 4 samples that registered as positive for microbial respiration, but a subsequent test found no signs of organic matter. Most scientists attribute the positives to a quirk of soil chemistry. Still, Curiosity has found evidence of organic compounds hinting at the past or current presence of microbial life. There is hope that Perseverance may finally settle the question. It carries equipment to search for the biological signatures of life, and the rover will drill into the Martian soil and eventually send samples back to Earth. The goal, said NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine, is to discover life on another world. When will humans go? NASA's timeline calls for a crewed mission to the moon by 2024, a lunar base by 2028, and flights from the moon base to Mars sometime in the 2030s. SpaceX is planning uncrewed missions to Mars about 2 years from now. If all goes well, says SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, he may launch a manned mission in 2024. But manned missions still face huge obstacles. On a one-way, 5 to 10 month journey to Mars through space, astronauts would be bombarded with so much radiation, it could cause cancer, affect their vision, and even disrupt their central nervous systems. As it stands today, we can't go to Mars due to radiation, said physicist Marco Durante. It would be impossible to meet acceptable dose limits. Scientists also worry about the impact on humans of a prolonged period of reduced gravity and isolation. Musk says the first travelers to Mars must be prepared to die on the red planet. Still, he said, it would be an incredible adventure. It's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with one from the U.S. David Graham at TheAtlantic.com writes, a blue shift is likely in November. The blue shift may decide the presidential election, said David Graham. In recent races, Democrats have benefited from a large wave of provisional ballots counted after the polls closed, sometimes changing which candidate won. In the 2018 midterm elections, blue shift votes tallied after Election Day gave Democrat Kyrsten Sinema a U.S. Senate race in Arizona and helped Democrats win 41 House seats nationally. Amid the pandemic, tens of millions of additional votes will be cast by mail in November. But President Trump has convinced many Republicans that mail-in ballots are tainted. This could lead to a massive blue shift in mail-in votes and a catastrophic challenge to the results. Let's say that when polls close, President Trump holds a narrow lead in one or more swing states that would give him an Electoral College majority. He'll declare victory. But as mail-in votes are tallied over the days and even weeks, Biden emerges as the clear winner in those swing states. Trump cries fraud and insists he's a target of a criminal Democratic coup. The country would be plunged into chaos. Unless one candidate wins by a landslide, Election Day will be more like Election Week or Election Month this year. This is from Spain. Post-lockdown crime spree is here. As Spanish society emerges from lockdown, the criminals are venturing out too, said Jennifer Creaser. Last year, Barcelona was in the midst of a crime wave with an alarming rise in street robberies of tourists. A visiting South Korean government official was even killed in a vicious mugging. Coronavirus travel bans and warnings have emptied the streets of tourists, and so criminal gangs are now targeting Spaniards. Robbers are picking on elderly people and women, stealing jewelry, cell phones, and wallets. These pickpockets are professionals, repeat offenders well known to the police. Yet because of a quirk of Spanish law, they can't be locked up. Stealing something worth less than $475 is a misdemeanor that brings only a small fine, and even multiple offenses don't rise to the level of a crime. That's why gangs of pickpockets appear so brazen, often working the same beat with no need to even hide themselves. Before the pandemic, violent muggers also routinely evaded conviction because their tourist victims often flew home before a trial could begin, and so they couldn't identify their attacker in person as required by law. Now that the victims are locals, they can attend trials and help ensure their attackers are put away. By the time tourists return to Barcelona en masse, we hope the streets will be safer. And this is from Pakistan. The next great war will happen in Asia. The West wants to stage World War III from South Asia, said Rehman Malik, and it has found a tool in Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The recent skirmish on India and China's Himalayan border occurred because Modi is under great pressure from the West to create a war zone with China. His soldiers received an unforgettable thrashing and Modi backed down. But the clash has exposed how fear of a rising China is dividing the world into two camps. On one side are the U.S., India, Israel, and Southeast Asian countries such as South Korea and Vietnam. On the other are China, Russia, Pakistan, and Iran. Washington's priority is to shut off Beijing's access to foreign markets. That's why the U.S. has reportedly asked the Indian Navy to police the Strait of Malacca, the main shipping channel between the Indian and Pacific Oceans, and turn back Chinese vessels. Closing that passage would make China dependent on Pakistan's Gwadar port, which sits opposite the Arabian Peninsula. China could transport goods over land to and from that port, which is why the U.S. and India are so opposed to Chinese investment in Gwadar. As a nuclear state, Pakistan cannot remain isolated if this war erupts. We would have no choice except to be on the side of China. Speaking of nuclear war, the title of our in-depth article this week is The Man Who Wouldn't Look Away. Major Claude Etherly piloted the weather plane that surveyed Hiroshima before it was bombed, said Ann Harrington in the New York Times Magazine. He was left racked with guilt and pilloried for his regrets. The B-29 bomber banked hard to avoid the blast. The explosion lit the plane's interior with a brilliant flash, so bright that some of the aviators momentarily thought they had been blinded. More than one noted a strange metallic taste in his mouth. A loud clap broke around them as the first of three shock waves hit, causing the plane's aluminum body to vibrate violently. Looking down, they saw the fireball unfurling. The American airman who flew the mission to drop the atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, were witnessing a man-made cataclysm unlike anything seen in the previous history of human warfare. They watched as fire swallowed the city whole. It was like no ordinary fire, a crew member later recalled. It contained a dozen colors, all of them blindingly bright. Just when it appeared that the explosion was subsiding, a kind of mushroom spurted out over the top and traveled up to what some say was a distance of 60 or 70,000 feet. The atomic bomb was the most ferociously deadly weapon ever created by human ingenuity, a technology that multiplied the power of these few men and planes to a degree out of all comprehensible scale. In Hiroshima alone, some 70,000 people were killed instantly, a horrific deed fit for gods or monsters. But overhead in their plane, the airmen were normal men in human bodies, no more able than anyone else to fully comprehend or bear responsibility for the mission they had been chosen to execute. In the ensuing decades, only one of the 90 servicemen who flew the atomic bombing missions, Major Claude Etherly, came forward to publicly declare that he felt remorse for what he had done. Etherly, then an outgoing 26-year-old Texan, piloted the advanced weather plane tasked with assessing target visibility over Hiroshima, giving the go-ahead to drop the bomb that day. His role in the bombing would haunt him for the rest of his life. The discrepancy between the tremendous power of humanity's inventions and the limited ability of any single person to comprehend, let alone control, the moral and practical implications of that power is what Gunther Anders, the post-war German Jewish philosopher and anti-nuclear activist, called the Promethean Gap. Prometheus is a character from Greek mythology who stole fire from the gods and gave it to humans. With fire, humans were launched on the road to ever more powerful inventions, a cascade of technological advances that would also unleash new forms of death, destruction, and exploitation. In the Greek myth, the gods punished Prometheus with eternal torment. For Anders, the U.S. service members tasked with dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the prime example of people caught in the Promethean gap. On the one hand, these U.S. servicemen were cogs in the atomic machine. They were couriers sent to deliver a deadly message about U.S. capability and commitment to winning the war. If one of them had declined the assignment, someone else would have stepped up to fill his shoes. Under these circumstances, it was possible to be guiltlessly guilty. On the other hand, as participants in and witnesses to the violence, these men came closer to connecting with the physical consequences of and responsibility for their action than any others. Once their initial sense of astonishment subsided, most of the airmen reconciled themselves to the bombings by focusing on their affiliation to their fellow American servicemen, whose lives they may have saved by obviating the need for a ground invasion of Japan. Others simply distanced themselves from the morality of the decision entirely. Colonel Paul Tibbets, Jr., who commanded the Army Air Forces unit tasked with delivering the atomic bombs and piloted the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, defended his actions until his dying day. "I made up my mind then that the morality of dropping that bomb was not my business," he told an interviewer in 1989. "I have never lost a night's sleep on the deal." Unlike Tibbetts, Etherly reported suffering from nightmares about the bombings, and his guilt drove him into a spiral of self-sabotage. In 1957, Newsweek ran an article, "Hero in Handcuffs," that reported that Etherly was in a jail cell in Fort Worth after breaking into two post offices in rural Texas. It described a tattered post-war life. Etherly had been in and out of psychiatric treatment at a VA hospital in Waco, had served time in a New Orleans jail for forging a check, and had been involved in a series of stick-ups at small-town grocery stores. But his crimes were so poorly executed, at least once he fled the scene, leaving the money behind, that his psychiatrist and one of his defense attorneys separately reached the conclusion that Etherly must have intended to get caught. At his trial for the post office burglaries, Etherly's psychiatrist testified that his patient suffered from a guilt complex stemming above all from his role in the bombing of Hiroshima. In carrying out these petty crimes, what Etherly actually wanted was punishment. A jury found him not guilty by reason of insanity, and he was released. Etherly's guilt fascinated Anders because it provided him with a glimmer of hope for humanity, a path forward for nuclear peace activists through the Promethean Gap. For Etherly, his dutiful service and the standard justification that the atomic bombings saved lives by ending the war were not enough to quiet his conscience. In 1959, Anders wrote to Etherly and they struck up correspondence. Anders was eager to co-opt the pilot's story in the service of generating political will to eliminate nuclear weapons, casting Etherly as a symbol of the future. For his part, Etherly quickly developed the hope that Anders would provide the platform that he lacked. Through writers like yourself, Etherly wrote in one of his first letters to Anders, "Someone will give a message that will influence the world toward reconciliation and peace. You may be the man. If I can be of any help to you, count on me." In a 1961 interview with reporter Ronnie Duggar, Etherly complained that he was not convinced by the orthodox explanation about the atomic bomb as a war-winning weapon. The Japanese were putting up so little resistance by early August that Etherly believed the war would have ended even without the nuclear devastation. Logically, he knew that if it had not been him, it would have been someone else to give the go-ahead and drop the bomb. Yet he still appeared to feel and suffer under the enormity of his role in the atomic bombings. Anders saw in Etherly's behavior a person attempting, in his own way, to be held accountable for his actions rather than finding ways to disclaim or reject responsibility. With Anders' encouragement, Etherly sent a message to the people of Hiroshima. "I told them I was the major that gave the go-ahead to destroy Hiroshima, that I was unable to forget the act, and that the guilt of the act had caused me great suffering," Etherly reported to Anders. "I asked them to forgive me. 30 girls of Hiroshima, young hibakusha, or atomic bomb victims, left alive but scarred by the blast, responded. We have learned to feel towards you a fellow feeling," they wrote, "thinking that you are also a victim of war, like us." By the early 1960s, Etherly had become something of a cause célèbre, especially in war-ravaged Europe and Asia, where his remorse fulfilled a deep-seated desire for compassion. In 1961, Anders published his correspondence with Etherly, complete with a preface from the renowned British philosopher, mathematician, and anti-nuclear activist Bertrand Russell. In 1962, Etherly was one of four people given Hiroshima Awards for outstanding contributions to world peace at a major peace demonstration in New York. NBC made a TV drama based on his story. The British papers embraced him as a symbol of anti-nuclear protest. Poets described his plight in verse. The more visible Etherly became as a symbol of peace and disarmament, the more heated the debate was about the sincerity of his experiences and feelings. Journalists wrote detailed books and articles examining his claims and motives. It is possible, investigative reporter William Bradford Huey asked, or is it possible, William Bradford Huey asked in his 1965 book, The Hiroshima Plot, that Etherly feigned guilt to attract attention and perhaps profit. Instead of guilt, Huey suggested an inferiority complex. The truth, he concluded, seems to be that when Claude Etherly began evidencing mental illness and turning to crime, he was a disappointed and immature man who thought he had been overlooked. Instead of being the hero of Hiroshima, he was a man who was disappointed at having been left out of the attack on Hiroshima. Etherly himself was silenced by throat cancer and died in 1978 at the age of 59 in a veterans hospital in Houston. We are now living in the 75th year of the atomic age. Etherly's experiences deepen our understanding of the human dimensions of what it means to undertake enormous acts of wartime violence. His remorse highlighted the ethical quandary of winning a righteous war that nevertheless cost such a huge toll in human lives. Passing judgment on whether he was a hero for speaking out about his suffering or a malingerer out to capitalize on his wartime experience became a way to stake a claim within the debate about nuclear weapons. Etherly was aware of his predicament, and it grew into a larger question on the use of nuclear weapons that would go on to outlast him and his legacy. I have been having such difficulty in getting society to recognize the fact of my guilt, which I have long since realized, Etherly lamented to Handers in one of his letters. The truth is that society simply cannot accept the fact of my guilt without at the same time recognizing its own far deeper guilt. This story originally appeared in the New York Times magazine. The lead article on the Health and Science page is Cruise Ship Offers Transmission Clues. Scientists trying to understand exactly how the coronavirus is transmitted have conducted a deep analysis of what might be the best case study of viral spread, the COVID-19 outbreak on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship. For researchers, the vessel was essentially a giant experiment in a bottle, reports the New York Times. On January 20th, an infected person boarded the ship. A month later, more than 700 of the 3,711 passengers and crew had tested positive, and many became dangerously ill. The scientists ran more than 20,000 computer simulations of how the virus might have spread, each with different assumptions for social interactions, how long passengers spent in their cabins, and other factors. Each simulation also took into account the contributions of virus-laden aerosols, tiny droplets emitted when a person speaks, breathes, coughs, or sneezes, which can float in the air for minutes and be breathed in, and larger droplets which fall quickly to the ground. Many clinicians have argued that these larger droplets, which are similarly emitted and can infect surfaces or people if they land on someone's nose or mouth, are the primary means of transmission. But the new study found that about 60% of infections on the Diamond Princess were caused by tiny aerosols. Good ventilation didn't prevent the virus spreading, the researchers noted, which suggests that people should wear masks even in well-ventilated spaces. Many people have argued that airborne transmission is happening, but no one had numbers for it, said study leader Parham Azimi from Harvard University. In this paper, we provide the first real estimates. And we'll turn over to the talking points page, starting with the NRA, should it be disbanded? The National Rifle Association is facing its worst nightmare, accountability, said Shannon Watts in USA Today. New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit last week seeking to dissolve the nonprofit gun group, calling it a breeding ground for greed, abuse, and brazen illegality. An 18-month probe revealed how the NRA's leaders, especially CEO Wayne LaPierre, turned the 150-year-old organization into a personal piggy bank while spending less than 10% of funds on gun safety and training. Instead, the New York State Chartered Organization allegedly used charitable gifts for private jets, Italian suits, African safaris, lavish European vacations, luxury black car services, and $18,000 in family wedding expenses. All told, corrupt executives allegedly squandered $64 million over 3 years. Perhaps more responsible than any other group or individual for America's deadly gun violence epidemic, the NRA had this reckoning coming. LaPierre's rock star style spending looks fishy, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. But the attempt to break up the NRA itself is a political jihad. James once called the NRA a terrorist organization, and this lawsuit is a clear abuse of prosecutorial power. For all of the NRA's questionable spending, said Jonathan Turley in TheHill.com, it is, by any measure, one of the most successful advocacy groups in our history, with more than 5 million members and a remarkable record of defeating gun control legislation and candidates from either party it deems unfriendly to gun rights. James may now be a liberal hero, but she hunted the NRA only because it serves its members so effectively. As much as I loathe the NRA, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, dissolving it would be a mistake, even if allegations of LaPierre's jaw-dropping greed are true. The NRA has a First Amendment right to its misguided understanding of the Second, and James surely would not attempt to disband the ACLU or Planned Parenthood over similar financial mismanagement. Liberals give the NRA too much credit anyway, said Bill Scherer in Politico.com. Even if the group is weakened by litigation, about 43% of Americans will still live in gun-owning households. With or without the NRA, a fervent gun rights culture will persist. If Democrats want more stringent gun control, they'll have to explicitly run on that issue, persuade a critical mass of voters, and get a mandate of action. Postal Service slowing down the mail. President Trump's new Postmaster General is wrecking the post office, maybe on purpose, said Michael Hiltzik in the Los Angeles Times. Since his appointment in May, Louis DeJoy, a 63-year-old former shipping executive and major Trump donor, has reassigned 23 experienced senior managers and centralized power around himself, restricted overtime, and instituted a new policy that late-arriving mail doesn't need to be delivered until the following day. Mail is now piling up at distribution centers around the country and arriving, in some places, as much as 3 weeks late. Alarmed Democratic lawmakers concerned over the fate of the 2020 election last week summoned DeJoy to Capitol Hill to explain the slowdown. There, in a closed-door meeting later described as a heated discussion, he confirmed his intent to cut costs and run the United States Postal Service like a business instead of an essential service. For years, Trump has wanted to take a wrecking ball to the Postal Service simply because it has a big contract to make last-mile deliveries for Amazon, whose owner, Jeff Bezos, also owns the hated Washington Post. This is a Democratic emergency, said Kristen Clark in USAtoday.com. With the pandemic making in-person voting risky, the outcome of the November presidential election will almost certainly be decided by mail-in votes. About two-thirds of states already won't accept mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. So Trump and DeJoy's decision to slow walk the mail could turn out to be among the most consequential policy decisions of the 2020 election. Those claims are just conspiratorial noise, said Tobias Hunhaut in NationalReview.com. The post office has needed financial reform for years. As the Government Accountability Office noted in a damning multi-year audit completed in May, the agency has accumulated $119 billion in unfunded pension and health liabilities, with its powerful unions blocking fiscal reform. DeJoy's effort to impose some cost-saving sanity on the chaos shouldn't be twisted into election rigging. The USPS could no doubt be more efficient, said Ben Mathis Lilly in Slate.com, but its unique mission to promptly deliver the mail to every street and dirt road in the country conflicts with the corporate world's profit incentive, and now is a strange time to radically change how the mail is delivered, given that a mail-reliant national election is looming. And it looks like we'll have to leave it at that. We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be reached at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.